Xian Chao grew up in China. He's a researcher at the University of Toronto, and he has been thinking about taking on what he calls an Anglo name, a name that English speakers in the West would know how to pronounce really easily. It's what his cousin did, it's what his aunt did, and his dilemma about whether to follow in their footsteps inspired some fascinating research in collaboration with a former advisor at the University of Kansas. His question was, do people respond differently on paper to white-sounding names? I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to hear that story now on KCUR's Central Standard. Xian Chao, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Tell me more about your dilemma. Why did you think taking on a name that sounds Anglo, as you put it, might be worth doing?
As a foreigner in the U.S., since the first day I arrived, I have been constantly asking myself this question. Should I adopt an Anglo name? And many times I feel if I anglicize my name, maybe my life will be better. For example, one time I applied for a research grant at the university, and after several months, I still hadn't received the results. So I contacted the review committee, and they told me they forgot to review my application. And similar things also happened at the conference. I received a travel award from the conference, which shows they like my work. But the conference moved my oral presentation to a poster presentation without telling me before the conference. And not just in academia. Many times I feel people don't have eye contact with me when I'm in a group conversation. So maybe people don't know how to pronounce my name, and looking at me makes them feel embarrassed and uncomfortable. So I also have seen many Chinese international students and immigrants anglicizing their names, including my relatives living in the U.S. So I think this is an interesting intergroup and cultural phenomenon. And after talking with my advisor,
Can we slow down a little? Oh, wait, sorry. I just want to talk to you more about this situation that you're facing, and we'll get to the research that you did. Yeah. You know, I went to college in the 90s. With a lot of international students, and several of the students from Asia did have Anglo names that they used with people like me, although it was clear they used other names with peers who were from Asia as well. And I was never sure where it was coming from. I felt bad for them because I didn't want them to be, you know, feeling like it was going to be too much work for me to learn how to say their names. At the same time, I thought maybe, though, this is enthusiasm for a new chapter in their lives. You know, I didn't want to step on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So one of the reasons they adopt Anglo names is because they feel Americans, they are not able to pronounce and memorize their name. As also, maybe some other people may think if using Anglo name can avoid being discriminated. We have more evidence to support the first reason than the second.
So had you considered taking on an Anglo name before these opportunities were kind of stalling out on you? It is really bizarre to me, by the way, that anyone could just forget to review somebody's application.
Yes, I was really thinking about adopting an Anglo name. But based on our research, we also show that anglicizing one's name may also have negative consequences. For example, anglicizing name is associated with lower levels of self-esteem. So people who anglicize their name generally evaluate themselves lower than who don't anglicize their name. That's one consequence. Also, people may feel a loss of identity. Like my name, it means significant and outstanding. It has meanings. It defines my ideal self and also my the expectations from my parents. So if I use an English name like Alex, I don't feel it has meanings to me. And so when people call me Alex, it may lower how I view myself. So I decided not using an anglicized name. And also my advisor encouraged me to use my original ASCII name.
Well, so this question, though, about what your name as it appeared on paper might have to do with missed opportunities. What did you end up doing to turn that into a research question? How did you transform that into a project?
So we did our first study in a field experiment. So we just want to compare people's reactions to the same target by using different names. And field experiments allow participants to behave in a natural way, and the result can provide strong causal inferences. And we send out email to white American professors and white read the name of the sender. And I use my own name in this study. And there are two conditions. In the Anglo name condition, I mentioned in the email that my name is Xian Zhao, but you can call me Alex. In the original name condition, I say my name is Xian Zhao. You can call me by my first name, Xian. And we found that the use of an ethnic name led to fewer responses. Xian Zhao has 52% response rate, but Alex Zhao has 62%. And besides, white American professors were more likely to agree to meet with Alex than Xian, especially among associate professors. And in another experiment, we also found this name bias can change depending on a person's belief. University undergraduates devalue Chinese teaching assistants who use their original name rather than anglicized name, but only among those who endorse assimilationism, who tend to think U.S. should only have one dominant culture and minorities should give up their cultural heritage.
So wait,
And yes,
can I ask you something? So you polled the professors you contacted on their general beliefs on this topic as well?
no, that's two studies. So in the first study, we only contact professors, see if they either respond or not, or see whether they agree to meet or not. In the second study, we measured University of Kansas undergraduate, their cultural ideology, whether they support assimilation or multiculturalism.
And so you compared those two studies to see that in an environment where the beliefs skewed one way or the other, that affected how people responded to what would be, I guess, a foreign sounding name, perhaps?
Yeah, so generally, if people they endorse assimilationism, so they were more likely to like the target, like the foreign visitor or immigrants who use an Anglo name than original ethnic name.
Were you able to follow up with people who did not respond to you when you said, "My name is Xian Chow. You can call me by my first name, Xian." Were you able to follow up and ask them, why
A
didn't you
little.
respond?
Yeah, a little bit. Because it is a study, we have to explain the purpose of the study after we complete it. So we send out an email with the goals and hypothesis of the study, and participants, faculty members, professors, when they understand the goal of the study, some of them they try to explain why they didn't answer, respond. Some people say, I'm really busy. I usually don't respond to students requesting meetings like this. Or some people, they provide other justifications. But some other people, they didn't respond to me at all.
What do you make of those explanations? Do you think that that can account for a 10% difference in how often people responded to your emails?
No, it's hard to say. I think there are research or theories showing that people tend to find justifications when they show prejudice or discriminations towards others. So
They find a way of sort of
to
explaining it
justify.
away, yeah.
Yes. So it's hard to say whether that's the real reasons or that's just justifications for their behaviors.
Were you disappointed to discover that bias or relieved that it wasn't your work getting overlooked? It's hard to say that that would be a relief, but I just wonder how you felt getting this information.
I'm worried, especially like now I'm on the job market looking for a new postdoc position for the next semester. And every time I submit my applications, I also still wondering whether I should put an Anglo name there in my CV or mention somewhere like in my cover letter. Should I do that? Every time I have been wondering. However, I decided not using Anglo name, because I feel we should not, as a scientist, as a integral relation researcher, I don't want to encourage minority to anglicize their names. But I do hope the society, the whole society, including members of the both majority group and minority group, to promote diversity and inclusion together. And actually, can I share that we are working on an ongoing intervention study, actually. So we are teaching people how to pronounce ethnic minority names. We simply train people to pronounce an ethnic name by showing them a YouTube video, and people can learn pretty quickly. Even though data collection is still ongoing, but preliminary results based on our pilot study suggest that learning to pronounce ethnic name may promote inter-ethnic interactions and communication.
How do you do that?
So,
I'm curious because I think like there are so many names out there, so it couldn't be name by name. How do you approach that big project of helping people figure out how to pronounce names?
So we have designed several studies. In this first study, we invited one Chinese international student and one white American student to come to a lab at the same time. But before we ask them to engage in a conversation, we put them into two separate rooms. And white American student, we show them the YouTube video to learn their partner, their Chinese partner's name. It's usually within 5 minutes, they can learn by themselves.
You mentioned earlier some of the reasons why you don't want to change your name or use an Anglo name that you offer to people as like, you could always call me this if you wanted. And I understand all of those reasons. I am curious what it is that just big picture, what a name means to you, why holding on a name has value, even in the face of real life consequences that you might face, lost opportunities, even possibly.
Yes, I can only speak to the Chinese name, I feel, because that's what I'm familiar with. Chinese name usually, it's not easy to name your kid. Chinese parents, they usually spend a lot of time, they look up the dictionary, because there are 5,000, almost 5,000 Chinese characters. And it takes a while to pick which name for their kids. And so parents usually put a lot of hope or wishes for their kids. And that conveys a lot of meanings. And when I grew up, I always try to behave like my name. I want to be outstanding. I want to become a significant person. So names has a lot of personal value to me. But if I use Alex, actually I don't know the meaning behind Alex. Maybe English speakers know, but I personally I don't know. And many times Chinese students they pick the name sometimes just because other people say this name is good for you. Or because when they learn English in China, their English teacher gave this name to them. So there's not a lot of meaning behind the name. So that's why I'm afraid to use Anglo name.
You talked about this follow-up intervention study you're doing, but what do you think that the rest of us should do with this information, like outside of academia, just people listening right now? What do you hope they do with this information?
Yes, I hope people can not only study one language, but become interested in learning the basic of a variety of languages just for the purpose of pronouncing different names. And that's not that hard to do, actually. And people always have a stereotype believing that learning Mandarin, learning Chinese is a hard thing to do. And I don't feel the same way, even though I'm a Chinese speaking person, but I have seen so many like Americans in China, they after a while, after 1 year or 7 months, they speak Mandarin perfectly. And people always worry about the tones, like in Mandarin. They say it's hard to pronounce the tone exactly. But I don't feel tones are that important. Like when people say my name, like Xian, it's not exactly the same tone. My tone should be Xian. But it doesn't matter because I can still recognize people calling me. So I want to encourage like people just
Just
to
try.
try to learn, and you can ignore the tone. It doesn't matter that much.
Well, Xian Chao, thank you so
Yes.
much, and thank you for forgiving that I don't have the tones down.
It's fine, it's fine. Thanks for inviting me.
Xian Chao has joined us from the University of Toronto. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR Central Standard will be right back with a discussion about violence that sometimes goes unacknowledged in our communities. More on that in a moment. Stay with us. Jussie Smollett's character in the TV show Empire is black and gay, and he faces all kinds of homophobia in the show, including his own father disowning him, going so far as to say he would celebrate on the day his son died of AIDS. The show does not shy away from the harsh realities plenty of gay people still face, is what I'm trying to say. But that cannot have prepared the star for what he encountered on the street in Chicago last week when he was physically and verbally assaulted for both his sexuality and his race. He was chased down with bleach and a noose. It was horrific. The news made CNN within a very short time, as well it should have. But violence against queer people of color is unfortunately not uncommon, even in our own community, and we don't hear about it as much when the victim is not a celebrity. So let's check in here at home. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm joined by two guests today. D. Rashawn Gilmore is here from Blackout. He's the president and founder of that organization. Hello to you.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
So maybe you could just give the brief elevator pitch type description of what Blackout is and why it exists.
We exist for reasons just like this, that we're here to advocate for Black queer men in Kansas City, and to make sure that we are not only visible, but also at the table.
My other guest is Melissa Moon Brown, Executive Director of the Kansas City Anti-Violence Project. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Would you do the same? Tell us what the Kansas City Anti-Violence Project is and why it exists.
Yeah, so we work with LGBTQ survivors who have experienced violence, harassment, trauma, neglect. We also are focusing a lot on anti-oppression work, so navigating systems that historically have oppressed, especially Black and POC LGBTQ folks.
Can you give me an example of what anti-oppression work looks like?
Yeah. So like recognizing racism within systems and how to navigate that, recognizing homophobia within systems who have historically oppressed us. But these are the same systems that we are reporting to in an attempt to seek like support and help.
And you both come to the work you do from a personal place, right? These are issues that affect you personally.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself from that standpoint?
Yeah. So as a Black, mixed-race, queer woman, I have experienced violence, hate violence on, I would almost say, a daily basis, racism, which most people will consider microaggressions, but I'm going to call it for what it is. It's racism, probably on a daily basis as well, especially with my position as an executive director and having to navigate spaces that where people don't look like me. So having those experiences.
And Rashawn, we've spoken a lot about your own personal story, but this continues to be personal for you.
It is. It's hard to watch a situation like what happened to Jussie Smollett and not feel personally attacked as well. And I want to just say it's important that even us as Black queer people, that we give space for Jussie. And the moments after the incident, we were all sort of triggered and we had these really visceral reactions. But I wanted to make sure that we left space for him. But moving beyond that, seeing this so close, that was in Chicago, Black gay man, highly visible, a star on one of the most popular shows on TV, and yet it still resonates with my day-to-day life experience and the experiences of those that are around me.
And Chicago being a metropolitan Midwestern place, it does feel close, not just geographically, but culturally.
Exactly. And you wouldn't think it would happen in a Chicago. You would think that there's such freedom and mobility for people of color or people who are LGBTQ and those who are at that crossroads. But the reality of it is that hate is not geographically restricted anywhere on the globe.
Was your visceral reaction sort of similar, Melissa?
Yes, I would say being the entire community's reaction was the same. So the important thing to remember about a hate crime is that it sends a message of hate to an entire community. So while unfortunately one person had to suffer, the entire community is suffering as well.
What does the situation look like in Kansas City from either a statistical standpoint or just, you know, on the individual level, as you talk to people, what is the situation, as you would describe it, with relative safety or unsafety for queer identifying people of color?
Well, I think One of the things that comes to mind for me, as you know, Gina, and your listeners may be aware, last year, Blackout conducted with the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Medicine's Community Health Research Group a community needs assessment, which looked at issues that impact the lives of Black queer men, in particular in Kansas City. One of those areas was on violence. And so we saw two very interesting things. One is that one of the places where, to Melissa's point about reporting to the same systems of oppression that, you know, that effectively oppress us, is that Black queer men don't feel safe interacting with the police. And so a lot of times violent crime goes unreported, or in many instances, we feel like there's no follow up or follow through. And the case that comes to mind for me is the death of a friend of mine last year in Kansas City, Teron Rio Carson, in Midtown Kansas City, leaving a club, Black queer man shot to death. And to this day, the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department has not said one thing as we approach the 1 year anniversary, one thing to the community about this case, nothing. So the message that goes out is that we cannot be safe. And if things happen to us that threaten our safety, then we have no recourse.
Can you tell me a little bit more? I mean, I'm sure that this is a really painful thing to talk about. This is your friend, but can you talk a little bit more about him and what happened to him?
Sure. Rio, as many of us knew him, was leaving Ara nightclub in Midtown Kansas City on 39th and Main in early March of 2018, and was crossing the street, crossed 39th Street, to wait for some friends who had parked in the CVS parking lot there. And so he sat on the bus stop bench there as they were exiting out. And an SUV pulled up. One or more assailants hopped out, filled his body full of bullets, and sped off. The community, in response to that, and KCAVP and Melissa's group were a huge part of this, we joined together to do a vigil and march. And hundreds of Kansas Cityans from all walks of life came to support. And on that night, we left with a reporter from KCTV5 whispering into my ear to tell the crowd that the police had found the vehicle. And so we thought that that meant something more would happen, but we've heard nothing. And so if you are a Black queer person and what Jussie Smollett experienced resonates with you because you've experienced something like that, do you then feel like the police care? The answer is no.
Melissa, chime in here.
Yeah, I just definitely want to echo what Rashawn is saying. I mean, it just sends the message that our lives are invalued. And this is on a national level. Unfortunately, that is the message that is being sent across the Kansas City metro area. Like, there is nowhere. Even if folks do reach out to myself or Rashawn, we still, in order to prosecute a hate crime, one, the police have to identify it as a hate crime once they reach the scene.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How that decision is made and what it means to you for this to either be called a hate crime or not?
Yeah. So to me, a hate crime is identified by any hate violence that is happening. But again, in these systems that oppress us, a hate crime is identified once a police responds. They have to check mark a box that says this is a hate crime. That then goes to the prosecutor and the FBI and has to go through so many channels.
Do you know what the criteria are for hate crime?
I'm not sure what the criteria are. That's on the police level. I can tell you what my criteria are for a hate crime. So any crime committed against a person because of their identity. So sexual orientation, gender, race, etc.
Does it carry like importance to you that something like this, like what happened to Jussie Smollett, be called a hate crime?
Oh, yeah, it's very important. But again, we're seeing, you know, police brutality against Black bodies happening. So when police do respond to a Black person, a Black queer person, and they're not identifying it as a hate crime, it gets really difficult to prosecute it. I think the national numbers are like 1 in 10 right now are prosecuted as a hate crime. And police aren't really even responding to hate violence, which is the root of a hate crime. So a hate crime, someone doesn't wake up in the morning and says, oh, I'm going to commit a hate crime. Like, there's hate violence that happens before that actual crime is committed.
You know, a couple of years ago, Rashawn, we spoke about a really painful local incident. A young gay man of color named Deontay Green was found murdered in his car. And there were many reasons to believe that his sexuality had something to do with the murder. It kind of went under the radar. There wasn't a big vigil or anything like that. initially, until people started saying, hey, like, this thing just happened and it happened in our city. Why isn't it a bigger deal? It felt like the conversation around it was a pivotal moment where people started saying out loud, in many different communities, there is a problem with race and how it gets overlooked within the LGBTQ community. People started to acknowledge that race affects how safe and supported people are in that community. Did that feel like a pivotal moment to you?
It did. And I would say that there are a couple of elements to that. One aspect of it is, yes, it did feel like it was a pivotal moment in that the community sort of woke up. By the time we, you know, fast forward 3 years to 3 or 4 years to Rio's murder, one of the things that we then see is this broad cross-section of community coming out to support in the way that they should have initially for Deontay Green. But there are a couple of other elements that really matter here. And one of those is that Black people generally, particularly cisgender, heterosexual Black people, often struggle too. They struggle to advocate for us and to see the benefit and necessity of doing so because they feel like... Listen, in the light of this, I had a friend's parent say to me, well, I really hate that that happened to Jussie Smollett. I love all my gay children, she said, but sometimes you guys need to just tone it down a little bit. So the answer becomes we have to shrink ourselves for our own safety. We don't get to live as we fully are.
The idea of what makes you a target or something.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what I said in response to her was, your daughter sitting over there, how would you feel if I said to her, well, you know, if you wear that skirt, you're making yourself a target for a would-be rapist or for sexual assault. And it never occurred to her in that way. And she was trying to teach, she wanted us to be safe and to be protected. But safe and protected can't mean that we don't get to be ourselves. So within the challenge is this. Sometimes we're too Black to be gay and be accepted by the mainstream gay community. And other times we're too gay or queer to be accepted by mainstream Black community. And so we live at these crossroads that are very, very difficult to thrive.
You know, can you talk a little bit more about the struggle you feel as far as being supported by the larger Black community?
It's getting better. And I'm not going to say that I think, you know, anti-gay stigma is worse in the Black community than it might be in other communities, but I do know that it is ever present for us. When you're navigating multiple marginalized identities, it's never easy sort of working your way through those layers. And I do think that there are more people who are beginning to show forth the sort of acceptance and love or tolerance, as some might say, but there are so many who struggle. And I know of a young person who just this year, I'm not talking about 20 years ago, just this year, was thrown out of their home at 18 years old for being gay. And of course, there were some religious elements to that. And I should also mention one of the things that we found in our study was that the second place that people felt the least acceptance and safety was in spiritual and worship settings.
So I guess like what I hear on some level is that this is, you're talking about forms of unacceptance that lead people to be homeless, which then does put you at like a heightened risk for all kinds of things, including violence.
Absolutely. And we know, I mean, Melissa can speak to this so well, but 40% of LGBT or 40% of homeless youth are LGBT. Of those, I've seen estimates as high as almost 80% of those being Black and brown queer folks. So that opens you up to a range of things, not only violence, but health issues and a range of other disparities.
Yeah, Melissa, please speak to this and within our community specifically, the Kansas City community.
Yeah. So just to echo what Rashawn says, I mean, that number is high. It's over 80% of homeless youth are Black and brown, and there are no protections. There is no safe space for them to go. And when I say safe space, I'm talking about, you know, a space that is inclusive, a space that, you know, allows them to facilitate healing on their own terms, a space that can sometimes allow exclusive spaces, because I think that's really important to have spaces where Black folks or Black and brown folks or people of color can gather to heal, to talk about the things that are happening within our community. So things like hate violence that we experience on a day-to-day basis.
What gets in the way of creating those safe spaces? Because this is a conversation that's been going on for so long, but it seems like the awareness that that's needed has been there. What gets in the way?
We're both chomping at the bit at that one.
Melissa, why don't you start?
Yeah. So I think one, looking at who are the key holders of those spaces. So do the people that are the leaders of those spaces, are they Black or Brown? How are they presenting?
So wait, you're saying existing safe spaces for the larger LGBTQ community?
Yes. Yes. So existing safe spaces.
Such as?
Just existing safe spaces. I mean, I know KCAVP was historically an unsafe space. It was a space that did cause harm to folks in the community because it was not represented by folks in the community. Another thing is, as people use this tagline, safe space, there is no such thing as a safe space. Like, you cannot create a safe space for anyone except for yourself. So I think it's important to reframe the narrative and when we're talking about like safe spaces. So a space we're offering to facilitate healing or to facilitate safety, because what might be a safe space for me as a cis presenting woman might not be a safe space for, you know, a Black trans woman or a Black trans man or a Black gay man.
Can you give me an example of a situation where someone may think they're have you witnessed a situation where someone has entered into a space believing it would be a safe space and found it to be not that, and kind of explain how that happens and why that happens?
Yeah, so I'm sure people have seen the spaces with the like little rainbow stickers, and they walk into the space assuming it's safe because they see a rainbow sticker or a trans flag, and then they're misgendered. That space is no longer safe for that person. Or I walk into a space assuming that it's safe because it is a queer space, but I'm the only Black person there. That no longer is a safe space for me.
Chime in here, Rashawn.
Specifically on giving an example of that. So there was a space that was ostensibly set up for the LGBT community here in Kansas City just a few years ago. I just returned from consulting in Detroit, Michigan, where they had a really defined LGBT safe space for people of color. But I went to this grand opening with my then partner, and we walk in and we're just saying hello and hi, and we weren't probably 10, 15 feet into the room before we realized that we were getting these odd stares. Like, you feel the eyes all over you. And as a Black person, you know what that is. It's like, oh, we're the Black people in the room. And although we move pretty fluidly through communities, and that's a point of privilege that I recognize, we were friendly. Folks were not as friendly to us. And so we decided to make a beeline for the back door. It was open because they had the No Hate campaign out there, ironically enough, doing a photo shoot. And so we started to make our way through, but I, as is my nature, paused because there was cake. And as we stopped for cake, there were two ladies, one older, one younger, and they looked at each other, and the older of the two hopped up and came over to us and said, you know, have you seen around the place? And we said, no, we hadn't seen around. She took us on a tour. We came back to where we started. I just want to make this point that she said to us, you know, we really want to get more young Black queer folk like you guys involved. And I said, well, you know, if young queer people, Black queer people, have the experience walking in the door that we just had walking in, not only will they not return, they'll tell their friends and their friends won't come. She said, that's such a valuable point. Will you please tell the director? So she went and got her. The director comes back and we relay the story, to which she rocks on one heel, sort of furtively looks into the air and says, you know, I think we just need to have a Black day. That no longer feels like a safe space to me. And I haven't been back since.
You know, I guess, like, I'm curious to know, this is a giant question, and we aren't going to like get the definitive answers probably today. But what do you think, just some ideas about what needs to happen to, A, make queer identified people of color actually safer? And then, B, what needs to happen to make the rest of us more aware of what you are dealing with so that we can be better allies?
There are a few opportunities here. And going back to an earlier question that you asked, why don't we have such a space? The notion of a space to facilitate safety, I think as Melissa put it, is so right, is needed. Part of what has to happen is that the majority community and the majority LGBT community has to understand that they have a role in ensuring that that exists. The other side of it is that we are just now, as a community, beginning to organize ourselves in a way that we never have before. And as we are beginning and building that momentum, we are coming to the table and saying, if you will not seat us at the table, fine. We don't even want to be at this table. We'll create our own spaces. And I can speak for Blackout in saying that just this past Sunday at our board retreat, we decided that in 2020, we're determined to make such a physical space happen. We invite people to join us in that effort, but we know we have to do it for ourselves because waiting for Superman is not a recipe for success for us. It's not a recipe for safety for us. We have to create that space and allow others to be a part of that. Too often, those who are so-called allies are not really allies. They want to lead the effort. And if you want to lead as an ally, you're not an ally. You're a control freak. You're part of the oppression. You're recreating the same systems that we're fighting against. And that will never work and it will never last.
You know, last one time, we've talked several times. And one of the early conversations we had, you said that part of the problem is that there wasn't a sense of leadership. Like, whose
yes.
problem is this to solve? And the answer, of course, is everybody's on some level. But the idea that someone is taking ownership of, like, this is mine. I'm committed to fixing this. I'm responsible for fixing this. And it does feel like that maybe has changed. I mean, just with sitting here looking at Melissa being the executive director yeah. of the Kansas City Anti-Violence Project. I mean, Melissa, is that part of what has motivated you to move into the role that you've taken on?
Yes, of course. And I think that has changed and it is changing. And that's due in part to the Black and PLC leaders who decided, like, we're not going to be a part of this system that continues to oppress us. We're going to create our own. And part of that is looking at, so part of what the work that I had to do as an executive director is looking at our programs and dismantling the way, white toxic culture plays out in those programs, because that is the culture that historically oppresses us.
Can you give an example of something that you changed, maybe even a small change you made that could make a big difference to someone in their feeling of safety, in their accessing something that might make a difference in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, just even, you know, the hiring process, I took out all educational elitism from everyone's role, including my own. Like, you don't need a degree to do this. What we found is, as, you know, Black and brown folks, like, we know how to navigate these systems and we know how to do the work more so than someone who read it in the book. Also recognizing, like, as a Native person, I don't want to celebrate Thanksgiving. And so allowing the option for folks to, you know, take off holidays that they want to take off. And then again, like, looking at the programs and saying, like, what is truly needed? And then, I mean, the difficult part is finding the funding for that. So it's important for people who are our allies to, like, we need funds to be able to do this work.
We have to take a short break. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation. 816-235-2888. We're talking about safety for people of color in the LGBTQ community. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about violence against queer people of color in our community on the heels of a high-profile incident involving a celebrity. We've talked in the past about this issue of Kansas City, where incidents sometimes go undiscussed without many people even knowing that they happened. So we're taking this time to check in and see what's changed, if anything's improving, what the ongoing obstacles are. My guests are D. Rashawn Gilmore and Melissa Moon Brown. Hello again to both of you.
Hello.
So something that came up in a previous conversation is whether you call these hate crimes or not. And we've discussed that a little bit, but why does that seem to not have the consensus around it that you would imagine?
For a few reasons, and one of those is that there are folks who are of a certain political ideology that for them suggests that any protections for any marginalized group is somehow an affront to their right to exist. That's one factor. The other factor is that oftentimes police officers don't take these matters seriously and they don't investigate them as such and they don't report them as such. And the third thing is it's important for us as a community that we continue to advocate for crimes like this to be identified as such, because they carry enhanced sentencing requirements when perpetrators are brought to justice. And it also oftentimes brings other resources to the table, including the FBI.
You know, it strikes me, too, that the kind of data you would want to know how big of a problem you are dealing with, if you aren't labeling the crimes in a clear way that's easy for everyone to agree on, like, how would you come up with the data? Because I do have this question, Melissa, of how common are incidents like like what happened to Jesse Smollett just on the streets of a city like Kansas City, do we know?
I mean, I think, again, it's important to note, like, people aren't coming forth. As a nation, like, we're spreading the message that hate is okay. And so if we're doing that, especially within institutions, I mean, there are protections being rolled back. There are policies that are upholding oppression against LGBTQ folks of color. So when that is the message that is being spread, people aren't going to come forth. Even Jesse, having a platform, struggled to even, you know, vocalize the fact that he was a victim, is a victim of a hate crime.
I can understand where it would feel uncomfortable because you're kind of inviting people to see you through the lens of, like, the words that someone used to describe you hatefully, or, like, just not wanting to attach yourself to what someone else did to you like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, having to be re-traumatized because so Jesse comes out, says, hey, yes, this happened to me. And then, you know, you have an entire community. So the Black community, like Rashawn mentioned earlier, who are saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have been out that late, or maybe you shouldn't have worn this, or maybe you shouldn't have been so flamboyant, or maybe. And so, like, it's continuous hate happening. So him having to re-experience all of these things.
Rashawn, anything you want to say about that?
Just that we live, well, I'll back up a step. I subscribe to the belief that you do have to call a thing a thing. And I think the thing that needs to be called out every time is that from the very uppermost echelons of political leadership in our country, the message has gone out that it is okay to target people in this way. And somebody says, well, what does that have to do with this incident, some guy in Chicago? It has to do with the fact that the assailants were both reported to have been wearing MAGA hats.
And make America great again.
Exactly. And said, you know, welcome to MAGA country, you know.
Words you're not going to say.
Right. Words I can't say on radio. So, like, that matters. And I also have to say, I don't know that this is something we necessarily need to talk about, but it matters when allies step in it, and that's important. So I'm going to identify an ally who stepped in it and made it worse. Ellen DeGeneres, whom I adore, have always adored, long before I knew she was gay, long before I knew, I just love her. She's great. But when she had Kevin Hart on her show, and she decided to, as a white, cisgender, wealthy, queer woman, absolve him of the harm that he caused and the pitiful apology that he gave, it's barely an apology, about the comments that if he had a tweet that he made, that if he had a gay son, he basically would kill him. Another comedian who's on the show, Really Real Jess, she made a comment in a tweet on Instagram yesterday calling a guy the same word. I mean, my point being that when this goes out, I don't care if you're Black, white, or otherwise, the message is sent that this is okay.
And that apologies have been extended far and wide. And or Kevin, forgiveness.
Yeah, well, you know, Kevin Hart, the and I've always been a fan of his, but what was so disheartening to me about that was he was like, I already did that thing. Like, I felt like I apologized. Why are you talking to me about this? And none of us ever felt that way. So I'm just saying, when we look at the situation, it becomes so real to so many of us.
You know, when we spoke on a previous conversation, 2015, Kansas City got a really unfortunate shout out from The Guardian for the number of transgender people murdered here in Kansas City that year. The number was something like 18 at the time, and it was only August. When we talked about what was going on, I was told that most victims in that 18 number were transgender women of color, and more specifically, Black transgender women. One of the guests said she felt like she was walking around with a bullseye on her. Are transgender women of color still being murdered in Kansas City at that rate, to our knowledge?
Well, this is a tough one. I cover this on my show a lot, too. The fact that already, I think last year there were 26 trans women who were murdered across the country. 18 of those were trans women of color. And of those, I believe 9 or 11 were Black women. And so the climate hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. And there are situations like, I think about Ed Buck in L.A., we've had two Black queer men die in his apartment after he, you know, injected them full of methamphetamines. It goes under the rug. Same thing happens with transgender women, only more so.
Why does it go under the rug?
I mean, just for so many different reasons. One, a lot of times we're seeing folks being misgendered from the media. Number two,
so the report masks who the victim was on some level.
Yes, absolutely. definitely masks the victim. Number two, I mean, we know like the most disrespected person is a Black woman, and even more so than that is a Black trans woman. And so, like, the hatred and the hate violence that happens against trans women of color, mainly Black trans women, that happens on a daily basis. So I'm seeing this every single day, probably two or three times a day.
I want to talk to Renee, who has called us from Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I'm next to a very rough neighborhood. My neighborhood's a little rough. Some of the people who walk in and out of the neighborhood are violent. I was speaking to a neighborhood officer who basically told me that if I'm going to walk around, I'm trans, and if I'm going to walk around, I need to be carrying a gun. And so that's what I do. When I'm walking my dog, I'm carrying a gun with me everywhere I go. How do we resist the temptation, which I'm sure the NRA would love to see come to fruition, which is that everybody who is in the LGBTQ community needs to just arm themselves? How do we go about resisting that temptation to go there?
Is that some, first of all, that advice that Renee, I'm sorry for the unsafety that you're experiencing, and thank you for sharing your story. I am curious if this is a, as Renee describes it, a temptation to just arm yourselves. Is that something you've experienced? Is that something you hear a lot? Is that advice something that is often given?
It is. So my car needed to go into the shop yesterday for repairs. They were out of rentals. And so a friend of mine said, oh, just take my car so you can make sure you get to the station in time. He said, in my car, don't be alarmed. He's got a pickaxe. He now carries a pickaxe in his car. In the event, it's very sharp, in the event that he needs to defend himself. And that happened after the Jussie Smollett incident. A friend of mine who's a Black queer man, too. We can't have this sort of armistice where everybody is armed and on edge. Like, nobody benefits from that. What matters is when allies who are true allies stand up for their queer family members, neighbors, friends, and they make the message clear that it won't be accepted, it won't be tolerated, this person is not vulnerable and alone, we are with them. And if you fight them, you fight us. And we're not going to have it in our neighborhoods and in our communities.
Examples of people who have done that gracefully in a way that was welcome, because I am also hearing these stories of people who have done it fumblingly and offensively. Attempts to be like, when you talk about Ellen DeGeneres, like, I don't know that that's what she was trying to do in that moment, but just it seems like that effort can become misguided. So some pointers, if that's what's important, how do you do it effectively, respectfully?
I mean, I think, again, one of the things is just standing up. That's never okay to tell someone that they need to arm themselves. Unfortunately, like, that's what we have had to fall to. Like, we know that people aren't going to protect us, so we have to figure out how to protect ourselves and each other.
So the better answer might be, how can I help protect you?
Yes.
Instead of, maybe you should carry a gun because you're not safe.
Correct.
And that's correct. Your problem, essentially.
Correct.
I mean, is that advice that you hear people relating a lot, that people have told them just get a gun?
Yeah, I mean, people are saying, well, just, you know, get a gun, or don't go to the police, or don't report this, or, you know, take care of yourselves and figure it out. I mean, and our community is resilient. And so we know how to take care of ourselves. But it's important that we do have allies within these systems that are standing up for us.
What do you tell people when they ask you, should they arm themselves? Do people ask you that?
No one has ever asked me that. But I would, you know, let someone know, whatever makes you feel safer in a country, in a community where you're experiencing violence, whatever you need to do to make yourself feel safe.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I do want to just quickly say, you know, we always talk when something terrible has happened, and that's, we should talk when those things happen. Is there something moving in the right direction that you can share with us on our way out?
I'm excited that you have two LGBT organizations that are led by two passionate and committed homegrown community leaders that are Black and queer, and that's Melissa and myself. So that may sound a little bit self-aggrandizing. I apologize, but I think that's worth noting because we are working hard, and we were committing in the Green Room to work more closely together. So that's my two cents.
Yeah, I agree with Rashawn, and there are so many other Black and brown leaders that are stepping up, and we're working together. So I appreciate that.
Well, our time is up. Melissa Moon Brown of the Kansas City Anti-Violence Project and D. Rashawn Gilmore of Blackout vowing to work closely together. Thank you both.
Thanks so much, Jean.
This discussion will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard. If there's someone you know who would really want to hear it, you can just send them the link. It'll be there by the end of the day, kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.